Hi, everybody. Welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's neuroscience research podcast. Today is September 14th, 2023, and we're talking with Carrie Cutler, who is Associate Professor of Psychology at Washington State University. Carrie is studying the effects of cannabis on human cognition, mental health, and stress, and its potential for treatment of a variety of conditions, including attention deficit disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and maybe others. And maybe we could talk about some of the others. Thanks for joining us today, Carrie.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us today are two PhD students. So Carrie was invited to UTSA by our neuroscience PhD program, and she was a student-sponsored speaker for this semester, which is a kind of special thing. And we have two neuroscience PhD students in our program joining us. Morgan Johnston, who studies brain mechanisms of motivation and learning in animals. Hi, Morgan.
Hi.
And Tony Alavato, who's a cognitive neuroscientist studying human language. Hey, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And me, I'm Charlie Wilson. So, Carrie, before we get started talking about the results of your studies, I think it'd be interesting to have you say something about special challenges of doing cannabis research in an academic setting. So in lots of states, including your own state of Washington, have effectively legalized recreational cannabis, meaning that practically anybody at the right age can walk in and buy any kind of that stuff they want, use it however they like. And on the other hand, it remains a Schedule I drug. In the federal world, it's not available, and there are crazy restrictions about its use and experimentation. So it's a strange situation. You know, normally the federal government promotes our research, and the states, in the form of the university rules, tend to impede it. And then here it is the opposite. And so what do you do to get around all that?
Yeah, it's definitely very strange. The Schedule I classification of cannabis has made it such that you need a lot of federal approvals before you can do any research with cannabis. You need approvals from the DEA, FDA, Department of Health, IRB, university, and so on. And those approvals can really take years to get. And then once you get all of those approvals, historically, anyway, researchers have been required to use cannabis sourced from the NIDA drug supply, which is really not representative of the high potency products that consumers are accessing and using. And as such, we know very little about these market products, and that has created a real pressing need to understand, especially cannabis concentrates, which are an extremely high potency version of the drug, and can exceed 60 to 90% THC. And so we saw this as a major problem. Now, since then, the federal government has made it such that there are more producers of federally legal cannabis that researchers can access and use instead of the single sort of source, the University of Mississippi. And that's made more products available and higher potency products available for researchers. The problem is that it becomes very difficult to get an IND to do research with some of those products because they're less well known to the federal government. And then the other issue is they charge an insane amount for the product. So, these new distributors for government approved research are charging like $20,000 for $200 worth of market cannabis. Anyway, I have circumnavigated some of these restrictions by capitalizing on the fact that cannabis is legal in my state. And as you said, anybody age 21 or older can go into any dispensary in my state and purchase these products legally, and they can use them in their homes legally. Not on federal property, but in their homes. And so what we've done is we simply observe participants using their own cannabis product in their own home using Zoom video chat. And we observe them using their product, and then we can administer tests and questionnaires and whatnot to examine the effects of cannabis that way.
A lot of cognitive tests are done by a computer anyway, right?
Yes.
So you just...
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Morgan?
I'm so sorry. I was hoping to ask you, since you do ask people to go and buy their own product from a dispensary, with the sort of dubious legality of cannabis, there's not so much regulation of like whether one product that you buy might have a certain percentage versus another, like, same product from the same company bought from like a different batch might have a different percentage. Is there a way that you control for that, or like do you have thoughts on it or how it affects your research?
Yeah, ideally I would be able to take that product myself and test it or have it tested, but I can't. I can't touch the drug as a researcher, unfortunately, so I can't do that. I have to rely on the labels, and we actually do know those labels are not correct. And we know there's more variability, and people who have other people who've done the research that aren't necessarily working at a federally funded university have found that these labels, unfortunately, are not very reliable. They don't really map onto exactly what's in there, but it gives you at least a ballpark estimate, a rough guide. So it is what it is.
Right.
But it's amazing that you're able to do those kinds of cognitive tests. Let's get on to a little bit about what you have found doing that.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we can just administer cognitive tests because a lot of these are sort of like just face-to-face, sort of like paper and pencil kinds of tests where, you know, we're reading participants a list of words, we're asking them to recall the words, or, you know, reading them strings of digits and they have to say them in backwards order, or they need to remember to try to do something at a later time. So a lot of these don't require any sort of special equipment or anything like that. In my more recent study, we wanted to capture some more like reaction time measures and use some measures that do require a computer. And so we've been using Inquisit software, basically, which is this software basically that you can remotely administer all of these established standardized cognitive tests to participants in their own home. So they just go onto the Inquisit website, they access the test, and then we can get the back data from Inquisit so that we get all the reaction time data and responses and everything like that. And with respect to what we're finding, I mean, generally speaking, what we're finding is fairly consistent with the literature in that we most reliably detect effects on memory tests. And those tests are most reliably detected on verbal memory tests. So again, where we read people a list of words and we ask them to recall it back to us freely, they tend to recall fewer words when they're under the influence of cannabis than when they're not. We are trying to move beyond that. So most of the research has just sort of looked at verbal memory. It's a very common type of memory test. And so a lot of people have sort of used that in research. I'm trying to go beyond that because I sort of specialize in memory and look at some of the less well-known domains of memory, like prospective memory, our ability to remember to do things, or source memory, our ability to remember the source of information, false memory, our susceptibility to remembering things that didn't actually happen. And my studies are generally showing some problems with verbal memory, source memory, people confusing whether they saw things as pictures or words. And then we see this increased susceptibility to false memories, where people are more likely to say that they heard a word or saw a word that was actually never presented to them.
So can we gauge the size of the deficit? So in some of your studies, you've asked your participants to get sort of as high as they would normally get.
Yes.
Whatever that means.
Yes.
And I don't know what that means, but presumably they consider themselves impaired in some way.
Yes.
That's what
intoxicated anyway.
Yeah, intoxicated.
Yes.
So, but when I'm looking at the results, it's not impressive that they were really, really impaired. Mm-hmm. But I can't judge that because I'm not so familiar with those tests. So how does the impairment compare to other kinds of memory deficits that might be happening under other circumstances?
Statistically, they're like smaller, moderate size effects. We get a rare, large effect, but when you look at the numbers, what does it actually mean? The social significance, they are pretty small. So verbal memory, as I said, is one where we see sort of the most robust effects. And it's like one or two words less and out of 16 words that they remember. So, you know, you read them a list of 16 words. A person who's high on cannabis might remember one or two words fewer on average than a person who's not high. So it's not like a profound memory deficit. It's not like an amnesia or anything like that. And it's all entirely reversible after 30 days of abstinence and even the chronic effects.
I'm sort of wondering if we were, and this might be a practical matter, if we were trying to make a standard field sobriety test for marijuana users the policeman could use to find out if somebody was impaired for driving purposes. What would be on that test? Do we know of anything we could use?
We could use this, for sure. There's too much variability in humans' verbal memory to begin with, right? They say sort of like 5 ± 2 is the average. But that's a big range right there, right? And especially if it's ±2, well, I'm saying it's 1 or 2 words different. So that would not work. We don't have any field sobriety measures. It's a huge issue in the field. And most regular cannabis users will continue to test positive for THC even when they're totally sober. So it's a major problem. I think that the main measure of driving impairment should just really be like, were they driving in a reckless, irresponsible manner, right? Were they in the wrong lane or something like that?
Of course, that would get them in trouble even if they were not.
Exactly, exactly, right? When you open the car door, does a cloud of smoke come out of the car? We have a problem. But it's a massive problem, and they're trying to find new ways of detecting impairment. There's a Druid app that they're trying to use now and trying to assess whether that can pick up driving impairment. It's looking at sort of psychomotor abilities and motor abilities alone. So one of the last tests in the Druid app is they have to stand on one foot, basically.
It's almost like the regular standard field sobriety.
Exactly. That's a major issue. We need better field sobriety tests.
I'm curious, just for kind of comparison, do you know how the impairment from cannabis is related to like impairment from alcohol, something that people might be a little more familiar with?
For driving?
For like the source memory tests.
Yeah. This would be an interesting line of research for sure. Mm-hmm. I would think that it would be less actually. And we see the same thing with driving impairment, that the mm-hmm. impairment from alcohol is much worse than the impairment from THC or cannabis. And the real concern is mixing alcohol with cannabis. That's when people are extremely impaired and should never be behind a wheel at all. But the driving impairment from cannabis is a much lower magnitude than it is alcohol. And both of those are way lower than texting, actually. Cannabis, I mean, the conservative estimate is that it might double the risk of an accident, and that sounds pretty terrible. But mm-hmm. alcohol can be like 8 to 10-fold increased risk. And texting is a 25-fold increased risk of an accident.
So I wonder, you know, where the deficit comes from, like distractibility or
reaction time. For driving, it's reaction time. Yeah. So what they see with driving is there's a little bit of extra lane sway, about 2 centimeters. It's not like they're going right off the road or anything, but there's about 2 centimeters more of lane sway. People drive slower. They drive further behind the car in front of them. They're not as likely to, you know, be riding up right now behind them.
Too cautious.
Yes, they're a little cautious. And then reaction time is the big concern, right? If a car pulls out, if a kid jumps out on a bike or like a squirrel or something like that, their reaction time is going to be slowed. And I showed my data today that indicated some of those reaction time differences. Again, it's not enormous, but it's enough. You don't want to have any delays in your reaction time when you're behind the wheel.
So I wonder if like the sense of being high is somehow an illusion, right? I mean, it's very hard to get a cognitive measure that seems to capture it.
Again, not in like any absolute sense. I think relative, yes, we see it. But in an absolute sense, no, that's very difficult to get at. And we, like I said, we really don't have good objective measures of actual intoxication, maybe red eyes and an odor of cannabis. A cannabis odor and some red eyes might give you an indication, but...
So, of course, the things that have been measured don't capture the entire spectrum of human cognition or sensory motor function, partly because there hasn't been a ton of research.
Yes, and partially because of the difficulties of doing the research. Yeah.
There's practically no, like in driving and drinking, there are like simulated driving, and they let people drink and from the simulator.
They do that for cannabis too. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, they do. I actually just met a scientist at a conference this summer who just did an actual road test into the Netherlands where they gave people cannabis and actually had them drive on real roads.
Not a simulation,
actual real roads. Yeah. Yeah, they didn't find much. But they've done simulator studies as well. Yeah.
Be careful when you rent a car in the Netherlands.
Yeah. I think they just did the one. I don't think they're regularly doing the research. But yeah, I was like, that's kind of amazing they were allowed to do that.
Yeah.
So a lot of the argument for legalizing marijuana has been based on the idea that it has some potential medical benefit. And many people claim to have received some benefit for whatever it is that ails them from marijuana. And there's very little in the way of medical literature to back a lot of those claims up.
Because it's hard to do the research.
There's been no research. So are there any does the FDA approve of cannabis for any medical condition?
Epilepsy, yeah. So especially like that Dravet syndrome, that very severe epilepsy that you can see in children. So Epidiolex, I think, is now FDA approved, I think in most states anyway. Well, again, medical cannabis is not legal in all states, but many states. So epilepsy, there's some good evidence that it's effective, and we would think that it should help with the side effects of chemotherapy anyway, at least with appetite, right? We know that cannabis tends to give people the munchies, they want to eat. So it can help with, AIDS and cancer treatment and stuff like that, we think. The other research is a lot more sparse and it's a lot harder. And the number one reason people use cannabis is for pain. And I've done some research where we looked at cannabis users' ratings of their pain before and after using cannabis and found that they rate their pain about 50% less severe right after using cannabis compared to before. But the problem is more objective measures of pain and laboratory studies don't always pick that up, and they don't always they're not always able to capture that and don't find any benefit aside from that's greater than what you would expect with a placebo or what you see with a placebo. So it's tough to find the objective evidence. But people report feeling better when they're under the influence of cannabis. And so I've done some studies by analyzing the back data from this medical cannabis app called StrainPrint. And using that app, medical cannabis patients can rate the severity of their symptoms immediately before and after using cannabis. They also input information about the strain of cannabis that they're using, its THC and CBD content and dose and all of that kind of stuff.
Which you said before is not accurate.
Yeah. Well, they actually pull the data. The app is pulling the data from the licensed producer's website. Uh-huh. So it might be a bit better. But we don't often find that CBD or THC predict a whole lot of the symptom change. So I wonder. But across the board, for various measures of pain, and I mean, we were able to look at over 150 cannabis use sessions by looking at these data over the span of several years. We see that people report, their pain's reduced by 50% or more after using cannabis. And then we've done the same thing with various mental health conditions. We see the same thing, about 50%, right? Their symptoms, they say, or they feel like they're just cut in half. So we've done this with OCD and PTSD and depression and anxiety. And they report their symptoms are half what they were before they used cannabis. But it doesn't provide any sort of longer term benefit, right? And it's difficult to stay high on cannabis all the time. And so, when the high wears off, which it inevitably does, the symptoms come back. And so they have to continue to use more cannabis in order to reduce those symptoms. And now you start to worry more about them getting into a cannabis use disorder, becoming tolerant and that kind of thing. So that's the concern. I say cannabis is like a Band-Aid for a lot of symptoms and that it temporarily masks them. But it's not really addressing the root core issue underlying the symptoms, like cognitive behavioral therapy might for you know, a psychological disorder like OCD or PTSD.
So you, I was just going to ask you, what are the prospects for the future? It sounds not great.
No, actually, you know, so targeting the endocannabinoid system might be the future, the better future. So instead of, or looking at some of these minor cannabinoids, I said I was doing one of the first studies looking at cannabidural, CBG. It's not intoxicating. It's not impairing, but it does seem to have some therapeutic benefits. And there's a ton of rodent studies supporting a huge range of different medical applications, potentially for CBG. So looking at some of those minor cannabinoids and the terpenes, but also looking at the endocannabinoid system and using FAW inhibitors, basically, so that the breakdown of our anandamide or naturally occurring sort of cannabis, right, our body's own form of it, to prevent the breakdown of that. So FAW breaks down anandamide, and if you prevent the breakdown of it, then you have more of it, and then people might feel better. So they're starting to do trials with people with PTSD looking at these sorts of drugs that are targeting our natural system. So people aren't getting high, but it's activating the system in a similar way.
And so those, so could we, what we would normally do, I guess, if it was serotonin or dopamine or something, we would look at the anatomical layout of the CB1 receptors or something and try to make guesses about where it would be effective and what kinds of things.
It's hard because, I mean, it's the most one of the most abundant receptors in the brain, and it's everywhere. It's in the brain all over. It's in the body. So it's pretty hard to localize.
And it's key in synaptic plasticity, at least in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. So looking for, I guess, memory seems like a natural.
Yes. It does a lot. It does so much. It's involved in feeding, reproduction, mood, depression. I mean, basically you name it, the endocannabinoid system is involved. Yeah.
So when you're looking at the endocannabinoid system as like a potential target for future therapies, is there any worry for like, earlier today you were talking about the effects of like chronic cannabis use, would activating the endocannabinoid system through like using like FAW, like you were saying, is there the same concern there, or do we think that it's like cannabis specific?
It's funny, I just haven't ever heard anyone raise that concern, like going in like with sort of like the endogenous system like that and manipulating it with these drugs instead. I mean, potentially, sure, I would think anything that you're kind of like bringing in that wasn't there before, your body might adjust for it. But I've not heard that concern before, just because it feels less unnatural, I guess.
Yeah, that's
true. Even though it's probably more unnatural, because cannabis is a plant, right? Mm-hmm. It's a plant that grows naturally.
Mm-hmm. Although we'd rather manipulate the endogenous
system.
I think in general, we'd rather manipulate the endogenous system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess that's how SSRIs work for depression, and not everybody's satisfied with that.
Right.
So maybe that way of thinking is not perfect.
Mm-hmm. That was sort of my thought process there, is that sometimes SSRIs can also sort of overdo their job, and so.
Yes. And they may overdo their job in cannabis users. I was mentioning this earlier today, that cannabis can sort of like slow down the metabolism of SSRIs.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and can also like clear antipsychotics more rapidly. So making the antipsychotics less effective, but SSRIs increasing their levels. It's really important. Cannabis actually has a lot of potential drug interactions with a huge range of drugs, and more doctors and pharmacists need to be aware of that and be checking levels of drugs in their patients to make sure that they're appropriate given their cannabis use status and the effect it's going to have on the metabolism of that drug.
So I could imagine somebody at a cannabis shop asking, customers, what other drugs are you taking?
Right. Yeah. The bud tenders, maybe. Yeah. I just don't think they would. I think the pharmacist is the one that needs to do that. Or the.
A lot of them do refer to their customers as their patients, I've heard.
Do they? Interesting. Interesting.
What are sort of what's next in the line of studying the cognitive effects? You have cognitive. You can see cognitive effects of it, and they ought to be linked to the experience that people are having. Because the thing that is mysterious to me is the fact that it's so desirable. People want to. If people take opiates, I kind of have an understanding of why they find that desirable. Their pain goes away, they become sleepy and happy.
I think it's the same with cannabis. Yeah. They feel like their pain goes away. They're a little sleepy and happy, right? It's like, I think it's
and hungry,
maybe. Yeah, it has euphoric effects. In the one study we did looking at strain print, the strain print data there with people with PTSD, one of the symptoms we looked at was irritability. There was a 67% reduction in irritability from before to after using cannabis, right? I think a lot of people are just looking to take the edge off, and it reduces stress. We see that's one of the number one reasons people use cannabis is to reduce stress. We see 58% reductions in stress from before to after use. Usually you see with drugs of abuse, if you give them to people in a lab, their cortisol increases. We just looked at cortisol at home before and after using. Cortisol goes down after using cannabis. Yeah.
Well, that explains,
in their home environment.
That explains a lot because it is an epidemic of stress.
Yes, we are in a massive stress epidemic. Yeah.
And so it's natural that would become the drug of choice for self-medication.
I was shocked during the pandemic. It became an essential service, right? The cannabis shops, the dispensaries became an essential service during COVID.
It was shocking. I never heard a rationale for it. Is this the rationale?
I think so. I think so. I think for the stress, exactly. And maybe that's why cannabis sales are booming so much that they're now exceeding Starbucks sales.
Exceeding Starbucks sales. Well, that at least explains that. That's one of the things I really wanted to know the answer to. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for
having
me.
Us, and also Morgan and Tony. And this has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.